sir.
All right. We all good? Are you so glad you had that much needed break after 2 weeks of class? Woo! It's quite a doozy. Okay, hey, good. All right, well, you found something to work on. That's good. I know, it probably would have come in more handy Thanksgiving week, but that's okay. You cleaned your room.
We got a bunch of emails saying that now there's, are we making up like a class day?
Yeah, we're going to end up.
The 24th of August.
I know, but at least it's Monday night. It's not like late in the week, so I know. Sorry, guys. I'm sorry for all of us, but that's okay. It's okay. What do you do? I mean, I guess they were just, the whole Logos building was shut down. And we have done that before where we met on Labor Day when there was no air conditioning. It was it was really kind of nasty. So it's just, yeah, it's probably better that way. Yeah, it was, yeah. So you can imagine this was a pretty, this was a pretty rough, muggy, hot weather. So I think it was probably better that way. Anywho, without further ado, are we ready to get going here? I'm going to push record on this one. I think you, yeah, Sean already got that one. Okay, let's pray and do this. Ah, Lord Jesus, thank you so much for this evening. Lord, thank you for this class, for this opportunity that we have to come and to continue to learn, Lord. God, I pray you'd help us all, myself included, to just lay aside anything that would distract us from what you want to speak to us tonight, Lord, through the lives and the testimonies that we're going to hear about, Lord. That you would just help us to just dial in and focus on what you want to speak to us, God. And so we thank you so much for this class, this opportunity, Lord. We thank you for all the classes, Lord, and everybody else that's in class right now around the building, Lord. Would you just be with them too as they are learning and pray, Lord, that you keep everybody alert. I know it's been a long day probably for a lot of people that are working and stuff, and so just keep us all just alert and ready to go tonight. So we love you, Lord. Pray that you bless our time in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so I just realized I'm going to need this. Here we go. Okay. Not last week. 2 weeks ago, we started out looking at the early church. Like I said, it's kind of hard to start, we're going to get on a roll here, and then we have a break, and then we have to start up again. So it's a little bit like we lost our flow a little bit here, but that's okay. So we looked at the early church and how some of its characteristics corresponded with Jesus' words to the church of Ephesus in Revelation. I don't know if you even remember that since it was a whole 2 weeks ago, but just to give you a little recap here. As we looked at this, as we looked at the early church era, we focused primarily on the beginnings of the church, the simplicity, the purity of the early church, as well as some of the doctrinal, theological struggles that the church faced against heretics. They had a lot of struggles and a lot of issues. That, you know, struggled with the Jews in a lot of ways, and you know, that whole dynamic as they were as the church was becoming more distinct from Judaism and all that sort of thing. But then, of course, like I said, the major issues that the church faced, the major struggles, had to do with heretics that rose up. And, of course, as we know, these led the church to become more organized and more systematic. And the Lord raised up these different church fathers, these guys, to kind of nail down and, what's the word I'm looking for? I'm kind of spacing out here. Okay. Anyway, I'll just say to nail down some of the doctrines of the early church. So to, you know, really just lay out a fundamental belief system. And what's the word I'm looking for when you put something into words, when you, it starts with an E.
Articulate.
It starts with an A, not an E. Yes, thank you. So they had to articulate these things, you know, and make it clear. With all of these heretics coming and attacking the church, the church realized, like, gosh, we need to be very clear about what we do believe and what the scriptures teach and what Jesus said. We need to make that very clearly understood. We need to lay out a fundamental belief system so that we are able to more effectively combat these heretics. And so this was a very helpful thing. This was a wonderful thing. This was the good side of what happened as a result of combating heresy. This was the good side of getting organized, was organizing and, again, developing a theological system and basis rooted in the scriptures. But getting organized, unfortunately, led to some negative emphases as well. you know, they placed a lot of emphasis on church leadership at this time and organization, especially with the office of bishop. If you guys remember, the office of the bishop became very, very important. And again, that was one of the, that was kind of one of the results of dealing with the heretics that were attacking the church. You know, one, you know, of course, one thing was that they had to organize the theology, but they also had to organize church leadership because there was an attack on leaders and questioning of like, well, who did Jesus really speak to, and how do we, you know, and these are the, you know, we say that we follow these teachers that heard from Jesus and these teachers that heard from Jesus, and the church said, no. These are the real guys that, you know, came and descended down from the disciples and stuff like that. And so that led to, again, an elevation of the office of the bishop. And that became very detrimental in future generations because some of these guys, there were wonderful bishops who were very humble and godly men. But in later generations, we find that there were men who came into this position that got corrupted by the power and got a little too heady. You know, they got a little too excited about the influence and responsibility that they had, and they became corrupted. And that, along with some of the compromise allowed in the church as time went on, led many to leave their first love, which is what Jesus warned the church of Ephesus about in Revelation, right? You know, that you've left your first love. And we see how even the early church, with all its wonderful characteristics and qualities, a few generations in, they began to struggle in this area and began to leave their first love and lose sight of just simple relationship with Jesus in the name of getting organized, in the name of, okay, we've got to have our church leaders all in gear and all that sort of thing. So today we're going to see that during the same time, we're kind of going to look at some things that overlap that, during this same time period. And this is the only time in the class where I'm going to have two time periods overlapping each other. Usually we're just going to go in consecutive order from one to the next, but there were two layers really of what was going on during the early church era. So I wanted to break that down. You had everything we talked about last class, all the theology, all the church fathers establishing doctrines and facing the heretics and stuff like that. But then at the same time, during that same time period, you had persecution of the church. And so while all of that other stuff was going on, while they're dealing with like the Gnostics and the Docetists and the Donatists and all those guys, there was persecution that began to rise up against the church as well. And so, contrary to what somebody would probably think, the severity of the persecution didn't actually stomp out the church. I mean, that was the goal, was to end Christianity once and for all, to eradicate it from the Roman Empire. But it actually did the opposite, right? It ended up purifying the church, making it more effective as Christians got back to basics and back to what their faith was all about. You know, it's very easy, even, you know, sometimes I think we like just idealize Christians in the early church era and think, well, gosh, they were like, you know, they all just walk well. I guess Peter did walk on water, but we kind of think like, gosh, they just had it nailed down. They didn't blow it in any area, but we forget that they were just as human as we are. And so just as, you know, we are, so too were they prone to wander, right? In different areas and in different ways. And so, even they needed to be, even in the early church, they needed to be called back to what their faith was all about. What, you know, what they really believed, and to really like find that anchor in Jesus and to remember who they were. And they got back at this time during persecution to what Jesus had told them in the Great Commission. You know, you will be my witnesses. That's what they ended up really doing during times of persecution. And so that's what we see characterized even in John's description of the church of Smyrna in Revelation. So as we looked at Ephesus last class and we saw the good things that the church did in combating heresy and in doing good works and all that fruitfulness, and then we saw that they had left their first love and all of that. We saw all those qualities with the Church of Ephesus. Now let's see what the Church of Smyrna presents, and we can see maybe a couple parallels here. So if you have your Bibles, go to Revelation 2, starting in verse 8. Some of you are already there. You read my mind. Okay. Well, I guess I'll let you get there. Here we go. Got it? Okay. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things says the first and the last who is dead and is alive. I know your works, your tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Fear none of those things which you shall suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison and that you may be tried, and you shall have tribulation for 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, or he who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death. Okay. Short little word there to the church of Smyrna. And I don't want to get too into this because some people actually, there's like historians and theologians who overapply this passage to the persecuted church because, for example, in verse 10 it says you will be tried for 10 days. You'll have tribulation for 10 days. Some people interpret this to represent the 10 Roman persecutions of the church, which we're going to be getting into tonight. It's kind of like, I guess, I don't know if you call it like ironic or strange or whatever, but there were 10 persecutions by the Roman Empire of the church. And so some people think like, oh, well, look, that's exactly what this means when it's talking about this in Revelation. It was like a prophetic word. I don't know about that necessarily. I think some people get too carried away with over-applying it, and I've already talked to you guys about that in the first class. I just, you know, and you might remember in the first class, I prefaced all of this by saying, you know, we want to use the seven churches as an application, not like an interpretation, like this is what it means, because we don't know that. And, you know, there could have been some other thing that John was talking about or that Jesus was speaking to that church at that time. But it is kind of interesting. It is interesting that it says you'll have tribulation for 10 days and that there were 10 persecutions by the Roman Empire. Another interesting note is that the name Smyrna means myrrh, and some of you might know what was myrrh used for? It was a spice used for preserving bodies. It was for burial, right? So kind of fitting that the name Smyrna has to do with death because that's what this church was facing. They were facing it here in the book of Revelation, and they were facing it during the early church era for a couple hundred years there. The church was, you know, constantly having to deal with trials and hardship, persecution, death. Like, it was a very real deal that they were up against. And so, again, those are all just kind of interesting things to note about this and keep in mind as we go through this. And like I said, if nothing else, it'll help you guys remember about the early church, is that like, oh yeah, Smyrna, that was the persecuted church, just like during the early church era when the church was persecuted for a couple hundred years. So, note also, Jesus had nothing bad to say, really, about the folks in Smyrna. They didn't get any rebuke. They were pretty much on the right page with all that they went through. And it's the same thing, you know, as we're going to see during this time of persecution. Whenever the church was facing times of trial and tribulation, they were very focused. They were very right on. And it kept them pure. And that's just, you know, strangely enough, that's what trials tend to do. You know, with those of us, when we choose to cling to the Lord in the midst of our trials, it ends up taking us deeper with Him, making us stronger in Him. And that's what we're going to see with the church at large, is that they experienced that same thing, that they got stronger and deeper rooted in Jesus as they went through tribulation. Now, as we talk about the persecution of the early church, it's probably good, obviously, to talk about how it all started, because it's, you know, it begs the question, what in the world possessed the Roman Empire to start slaughtering Christians, and, you know, what instigated all of this in the first place? I can understand why the Jews were mad at the Christians, but why was Rome so upset with them? Well, you already read about this in your book. Your book outlines several reasons why the church was a major target of the empire. And, you know, you could probably even have told from the first class when we talked about some of the characteristics of the early church, how distinct the church was from the world around it. And so the Christians were, from the beginning, bound to stand out from Roman culture. And so really, I would say most of the reasons for persecution boiled down to the fact that the Christians were different. They stood out from the norm, and therefore they were an easy target, I guess you could say, as a result. And that's, you know, that's how it should be, really. You know, we even today, we should be an enigma and even an enemy to the world around us. And you know, we're finding ourselves in that position more and more in our day and age, where, you know, Christians are more and more marginalized or more and more under attack. Right now, maybe it's only verbal, but who knows? It may only be a matter of time before that starts taking another form. We know around the world, in places like Indonesia and China and stuff, Christians are legitimately, like, persecuted. You know, everything going on with ISIS. And so we see that a lot of that does have to do with the fact that we stand out, you know, and the enemy has an agenda to come after and attack the people of God. And so we see that pretty clearly here during this time as well. And so just to list a few of these things as by way of recap and kind of tying everything together with what you've studied already in the book, I would say the first, you know, I kind of boiled it down to three key areas or reasons, I guess, why the church was persecuted. In the first place, I would say it was a matter of politics. The Roman political perspective, in reference to various religions of the empire, was one reason why the church was persecuted. And as your book talks about, the Romans were actually very tolerant of other faiths, which is kind of surprising. You think that they would, like, just try to, you know, squash everybody and, like, force them into conformity and all that sort of a thing. But they were actually very tolerant as long as the emperor was revered. The Roman emperor was still honored and revered. They were fine with that. Really, the only exception that the Romans made in this, in their policy, was with the Jews. The Jews were the only exception because they insisted so much on worshiping only Yahweh, the one true God. It was like, okay, you know, the Jews are just, they're stubborn guys, right? They're stubborn folks. And so the Romans, like, could not get them to, you know, concede that point. And so, but the thing is about the Jews is they kept mostly to themselves, which is actually kind of tragic. They weren't supposed to do that, right? They were supposed to be a light to the nations. But they kept to themselves for the most part. And so Rome was like, you know what? These guys are annoying because they won't, you know, play ball. They won't kind of join in with what everybody else is doing in our general policy. But as long as they keep to themselves and don't disturb the peace, we can kind of just let them hang. And so the Romans didn't consider the Jews to be much of a threat or a concern. They kind of just humored them. And so as long as the Christians appeared to be part of the Jewish culture, part of Jewish religion, in Rome's eyes, they were harmless. But remember, we talked about this last week, the destruction of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple and everything in 70 AD, at that time, the Jews began to make it very clear that the Christians had no part with them, that they were distinct and separate. And they've been saying that earlier. I mean, we even know in the book of Acts how, you know, there was such conflict and tension between the Judaizers and the, you know, Gentile Christians and all that sort of a thing. So there was all, you know, there was already tension in that way. But the breach between Jews and Jews and Christians became even more clear and distinct after 70 AD. And so Rome began to realize this. You know, they, you know, like I said, from a pagan outsider's perspective, Christians and Jews seemed the same early on. As soon as the distinction was more clear, then Rome was like, oh, wait a minute, this is a different group. And they also started to see not only that Jews and Christians were separate from one another, but they also began to see that Christians were more aggressive in evangelizing or proselytizing than the Jews were. The Romans began to see, oh, wait a minute, these Christians, they're not like the Jews. The Jews keep it to themselves. They kind of just do their thing in their own little community. They're all self-contained. But the Christians are out trying to, like, win the whole empire over to Christ. They're very aggressive. And they're not keeping to themselves. And so, as a group so uniquely different from what Rome was used to dealing with, the Christians posed a more serious threat to the Roman way of life. And so, again, politically speaking, it looked like they were up to something. And so that was one major reason, was just the politics in general of the empire. This is one reason why they ended up getting persecuted, was just, yeah, because they were a little too aggressive. They were, you know, a little a little more outspoken than the Jews. Yes.
Because of that, and they also still denied, like,
yes, we're going to get to that. Yes. So, yes, so we have that. And then secondly, the second area, or second reason, I would say, why the church was persecuted had to do just simply with Christian beliefs and practices, just the things they believed and the practices they engaged in. Those in and of themselves rubbed people the wrong way. Christians believed a lot of things that were considered odd to the pagan mind. They rejected all of the deities of the Romans. You know, the Romans had multiple gods. We even see that in the book of Acts when Paul is on Mars Hill, you know, and there's just like all of these gods and idols all over the place. And there's even a shrine to the unknown God to make sure they covered all the bases, right? So that's how they rolled. And so the Christians were strange because they served only one God, and it was a God that was not represented by any image or by any idol. And so, as you guys know from the reading, oddly enough, that led to Christians being labeled atheists, which was, you know, kind of strange, kind of funny, really. But that's what they looked like to Romans, because it's like, well, you don't have any idols or any statues. You must not even believe in a God at all. Who, you know, what's wrong with you guys? And so, as I've already And then, as we've already discussed, they also rejected, Christians also rejected a lot of the activities, the entertainment that the Romans engaged in, like, you know, going to the Colosseum and watching gladiator battles and animal fighting and, you know, men and animals killing each other. And they also would not work in any job that might be connected to Roman deities, so things like incense making or even school teaching, those kind of things were off limits to the Christians because they would lead them to compromise. They'd have to start teaching, you know, about Roman religion and idolatry, and they just couldn't do that with a clean conscience, obviously. So the Christians had to find jobs and employment that was outside of any connection with temple activity and stuff like that. And so that was odd. That was unusual because nobody else thought about it. Everybody just kind of rolled with it. And even all of the nations that Rome conquered, you know, for the most part, they were all polytheistic. They had no problem with all the idols and stuff like that. The Christians were the only ones that were really, like, having an issue with this and were more vocal about it and more aggressive in speaking against it than the Jews were. And so these kinds of things, like I said, rubbed people the wrong way. The Christians also had practices that were rumored to be strange, like partaking of the Lord's Supper, using the holy kiss with one another. And once the church became illegal, Christians generally had to be on the DL and very secretive all the time. And even though they did it out of necessity, that gave the pagan mind freedom to kind of imagine all kinds of crazy things that the Christians must be doing. It's kind of like, well, gall, you know, what are they supposed to, they're underground, they have to be meet in secret and everything, and so the pagans are like, well, I wonder what they're doing in all their secret meetings. They're probably all, like, you know, having orgies and all these crazy things. And it's like, you know, they just, the Christians couldn't win, you know, you're just, they're just kind of in trouble no matter what they did. And so, as you guys know, the Lord's Supper was rumored to be this cannibalistic affair where they were eating the flesh and drinking the blood of their master, or just gross, creepy stuff. And then, like I said, the use of the holy kiss led the Romans to believe that Christians were engaged in some kind of nasty orgy stuff when they met together. And so, obviously, the Christians were completely misunderstood by people that had no experience or knowledge or understanding of what they were doing in their meetings, because nobody even went to go and find out. They just knew, oh, they're meeting secretly, probably because they're doing something bad. And so, and yet it was because the Christians were so different from the rest of society, that's what led people to believe things like this. It's like, well, they are kind of different. Well, they are kind of out there a little bit, and they don't do what we do, so they must be doing something wrong. And so it really wasn't too much of a stretch for the Romans to find a convenient scapegoat in Christians whenever tragedy struck the empire, because they figured, well, the Christians are these secretive ones that are weird and they're probably up to no good, and so I wouldn't put it past them to do something bad to sabotage the empire. That was kind of the mentality and the reasoning. They figured the Christians must be up to no good because they're so different from us, so distinct. They're probably, you know, trying to you know, cause an insurrection and rebel against the empire and stuff like that. So those were two things, just the politics in general, Christian beliefs and practices. Those were reasons for persecution, but probably the biggest reason overall for the persecution of the church, especially over such a long period of time, had to do with emperor worship, as Roland pointed out earlier. And you could lump that in with politics, but emperor worship in and of itself was such a major issue for the Romans, and such a, you know, such a very clear demarcation between Christians and pagans. You know, I mean, the Christians were the only ones who would not bow to the emperor, and so that was a really big deal. Now, where did this come from? Why was emperor worship such a big deal? Well, as you guys know, the Roman Empire was growing and growing, right, leaps and bounds, and it became more spread out and more difficult to control as it grew. And it's really hard to take over a bunch of random people groups with different customs, different languages, different religions, and try to, you know, get them all unified and on the same page. Usually you're going to have a few, you know, hiccups, a few bumps along the way, trying to bring everybody together. And clearly the Romans realized, as the empire continued to expand and enlarge, and as they continued to take over different people groups, they realized, you know what, we need to take some steps towards unification here. Otherwise, the whole thing's going to fall apart. It's not going to survive. Everybody's just going to kind of rebel and go back to doing what they were doing before. We need allegiance. We need unification. And so how do we secure that allegiance? How do we get everybody, you know, to really be loyal to Rome? And so through a series of events, it was decided that promoting, and not just promoting, enforcing worship of the emperor as a deity, as a god, that would serve as the most powerful unifying force. And that was a smart move, because throughout history, we see that religion is a very powerful political force. We're going to see the church learn that for themselves in a couple classes from now. So the church later discovered that religion was a powerful unifying force, and that was kind of unfortunate. But, like I said, Rome did this, and for the most part, it worked. They were able to get most people on board. Like I said, they were conquering a lot of people groups that already were polytheistic, that had a lot of deities, and so if they were forced to worship the emperor, it was like, well, okay, we'll just add him in, I guess, and we'll be loyal to Rome, whatever. So, again, it worked for the empire at large, but not for the Christians. Not for the Jews either, but, again, the Jews, because they kept to themselves, they were not considered as big of a deal or as big of a threat. But the Christians were. Remember, Christians obviously were fundamentally different from all of these other people, and so there was no way that they were going to bow to Caesar when they believed Jesus was Lord. And so even though it had to do with their faith and their relationship with God, it had nothing to do with trying to be subversive or trying to rebel against Rome. It had nothing to do with that. But from the Roman perspective, I mean, all they could see was that the Christians were, you know, separating themselves from everybody else and doing their own thing. And so that looked like rebellion. It was viewed as a sign of disloyalty and treachery. And so C.P.S. Clark says that Rome actually viewed the church much as a gigantic Sinn Féin or trade union organization might be, as an independent and possibly hostile state within the state. So, again, from the Roman perspective, that's what the church looked like. It looked like they're up to something. And so Jennings summarizes with this. This is how he kind of summarizes the whole thing. Christianity would thus rouse hostility as being new, not national, indeed a revolt from national religion. It was not a religio licita, like a legitimate religion, not even recognizing the emperor's divinity, yet itself intolerant and actively aggressive. Further, Christianity had no sacrifices, no temples, no statues, etc. Far from parading itself externally, it deliberately confined its appeal to the conscience and the heart. This position was misunderstood, and the Christians were ranked with the atheists, a class particularly hateful to Roman ideals. Christianity also offended by the mysterious secrecy of its gatherings. So again, that kind of summarizes the whole picture and the whole perspective as to why Rome was so anti-Christian and why they were so suspicious and why they were felt so threatened by the church. Even though, again, the church was not in any way intending to, you know, cause some kind of political problem. That was not what they were after, but that's what it looked like. And so, you know, you can imagine, you know, if you were a Roman and you're watching the Christians do their thing and you see Christians out trying to convert everyone, it's like, wait a minute, you know, obviously from their perspective, it does look subversive. It does look aggressive and hostile. And so Rome became even more convinced when the Christians were out, you know, sharing the gospel and everything, that they were trying to stir up a rebellion. So they needed to be stomped out before things got too far. And so there's a contemporary Christian work of the early church called the Book of Wisdom. And the Book of Wisdom, it kind of describes the pagan mentality like this. And this is what, you know, what they would say was what the Roman mind was. Let us lie in wait for the righteous, for the Christian, because he is not for our turn and is contrary to our doings. He upbraideth us with our offending the law. He professes to have the knowledge of God. He calls himself a child of the Lord. He was made to reprove our thoughts. He is grievous to us even to behold, for his life is not like other men's. His ways are of another fashion. We are esteemed of him as counterfeits. He pronounces the end of the just to be blessed and makes his boast that God is his father. Let us see if his words are true, and let us prove what will happen in the end to him. Let us examine him with spite and torture, that we may know his meekness and prove his patience. Let us condemn him with a shameful death, for by his own saying he shall be respected. And so that, you know, was, you know, even though that's a Christian writing about the pagan mentality, that's, you know, kind of the mentality that they did have, was like, oh yeah, you guys, you know, let's see how, you know, how you stick to your guns now if we start turning up the heat around you a little bit. Because, of course, again, if they're a threat to the Roman Empire, we need to stomp these guys out. And so with that attitude and that perspective, obviously the stage was set for an all-out attack on Christianity and on the Christian people, because they were uncooperative, they were abnormal, totally unwanted. And so really it was no skin off anyone's nose to just try to get rid of them. So what happened was, in 67 AD, the city of Rome experienced this devastating fire that lasted for several days. And during the fire, it was rumored that Emperor Nero was outside the city on a hill playing the lyre, probably, or like a harp thing. later on in history, somebody wrote down he was playing the violin, but I'm like, the violin hadn't been invented yet, so I don't know how that was possible unless he invented it there on the hill. So anyways, he was out chilling out, playing music, basically, and just watching the city burn. And, you know, I mean, Nero was deranged, so I wouldn't put it past him anyway, just because he was, like, mentally off. But, you know, it's quite possible that he did instigate the fire and then just go out and chill and wait for it to die out. Because what happened was, after the fire was over, it just so happened that the majority of the fire had been set in a kind of a lower class, run-down area of the city. And so that area, you know, it burns up and everything. And then after the fire, Nero goes in and decides to build a huge palace on the site, on the ruins of the fire. And so it's kind of like, people are getting a little bit suspicious, like, that's a little weird. And wasn't he kind of just hanging out, like he wasn't even surprised that this happened? And so people started to put things together and suspect him. And so when Nero heard that rumors were circulating about him, I'm like, what an idiot to think that nobody would figure this out. You know, it's like, anyway, when he realized that rumors were circulating, he saw that he needed to pin the tragedy on somebody else. He's like, oh crud, what do I do now? I got to blame somebody else for this fire. What am I going to do? And so he thought, you know, about like different people that were in the city and in the empire. He's like, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll blame the Christians. Nobody cares about those guys. And they're kind of weird. They practice things that are different. They're kind of already are causing tensions between people. And so he decided that by blaming the Christians for the fire, he would be able to kind of turn the anger of the people away from him. They'd, you know, it would kind of distract them from suspecting him of doing anything wrong. And it worked. And he ended up instigating the first official persecution of the church. And so from this time on, the precedent was set that anything bad that happened in the empire was somehow the fault of the Christians. You know, because people remembered back to this time, and they thought, well, remember during Nero's time when the Christians set fire to Rome. And so that once that rumor got going, you know, people always remembered that and continued to blame the Christians when other bad things would happen in the empire. Now, there were, like I said, 10 distinct periods of, I guess what you would call official persecution of the church, where the Roman emperor himself kind of endorsed and instigated the persecution. Thank you. That was a good word. But there were a lot of other, like, isolated outbreaks. There was persecution going on in different regions all the time. Maybe a governor over here that didn't like Christians, or a consulate here, they, you know, were upset, or this council member, whatever the case may be. But, you know, again, as far as the emperor himself was concerned, the emperor endorsed 10 major ones. The first 6 of these major persecutions were localized. They were kind of concentrated in just specific areas of the empire. But during the 7th persecution under Emperor Decius, which we'll get to eventually, everything kind of changed. He was the first one to declare an empire-wide persecution, where we're going to like try to get rid of Christianity all over the empire. And so from then on, the amount of martyrdoms increased pretty dramatically. In the 100s AD, there were about, that we have count of, that we have documented, there were about 80,000 total Christians killed. But by the 200s, the numbers kind of jumped drastically, like I said, once empire-wide persecution was taking place. And at that point, there were hundreds of thousands of Christians that were dying. And yet, remember what Tertullian said, right? What did he say? The blood of the martyrs? Is the seed of the church. I know Rob knows that one. That's right. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. And so in spite of how overwhelming the massacre seemed at times, the gospel continued to spread like wildfire. Really, no act of Rome could stomp out Jesus, could stomp out his followers. And so that's what we're going to see during this time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through each of the 10 persecutions. If you guys read Fox's Book of Martyrs, it goes into even more detail there. And I'm going to just try to highlight some of the interesting stories that are historically reliable that we know. There's certain accounts that we have that we know are pretty, you know, pretty factual. There's also, you know, some stories that kind of grew into legend and everything, so you have to kind of sift through that. I do recommend Fox's Book of Martyrs if you guys haven't read it before. It's pretty eye-opening, pretty sobering. It's a really good book. It's a, you know, Christian classic, so, you know, I feel like everybody should at least read some of it at some point. It used to be a required reading, so you can thank me for that. I don't require it anymore. Yeah, you know. James knows. He had to read it. But don't you feel enriched, like you're a better person?
The stories in there are unbelievable.
See? Yeah, there we go. All right, so. Thank you for that. All right. I'll pay you later. I'm just kidding. No, it is a good book. So, was I going to say? Okay, yeah. So getting into, but let's just go ahead and get launch right into the first persecution here under Nero. That's Nero there in 67. I already talked about how Nero came to persecute the church in the first place. As you know, he came up with a lot of really just evil and sadistic methods of torture. He would sew Christians up in animal skins and have dogs chase them until they died. And he also lit his gardens with Christians that were dipped in wax shirts, right? You guys read about that, how he would tie the Christians to a post and put these wax shirts on them and then just light them in his garden. So it was like human candles. And then he just cruised through his garden at night and there's people screaming around him and the smell of burning flesh. I mean, he was just sick, twisted, demonic man, okay? So, I mean, yeah. It just got way out of hand. Even the Roman historian Tacitus says that Christians were being destroyed not for the public good, but to gratify the cruelty of an individual. And this is an unbelieving man who witnessed this whole thing. And he said, you know, he could just tell that this was, there was no good reason for this. Nero was just sadistic and cruel. And so those martyred at this time include the apostles Paul and Peter, as well as several of the 70 disciples that are mentioned in Luke chapter 10. Many of those folks laid down their lives during this time. And so that, you know, and again, that gives perspective. You know, I'm going to talk about this a little bit later as we go along here, but, you know, remember who was the emperor during the time of Paul and Peter and these guys, and when they're talking about fear God and honor the king and all that, I mean, they're talking about a real cruel and twisted man, and yet they were, you know, as best they could, honoring and respecting that authority, which is pretty mind-boggling. Obviously, when it came to preaching the gospel, they were, you know, they considered themselves above that authority, you know, and we know that, that they said, you know, we must follow God and not man. But in every other way, they tried to be good citizens and supportive, and I think that's just amazing. So, I mean, when you look at what was going on during the time, it really puts perspective to what the, you know, what the epistles in the New Testament are talking about. So, that's Nero, and then we have the second persecution under Domitian in 81 AD. As with the persecution under Nero, Domitian's persecution was instigated by false accusations, once again, against the Christians. In fact, a lot of the accusations were totally ludicrous, ridiculous stuff, even just kind of like all that stuff about the Holy Kiss and, you know, the cannibal orgies and all of this sort of thing. But people believed it anyway, because again, what they didn't understand, they, you know, just marginalized and were like, oh, we don't understand what they're doing. The Christians are strange, and so they must be up to no good. And so they would just kind of, a lot of people just bought this hook, line, and sinker, unfortunately. During this time, Paul's spiritual son Timothy was martyred. The apostle John was also sent into exile on the island of Patmos, and we know what happened there, right? What happened on Patmos? Revelation, yep, right? Okay, yes, which we were just reading, the book of Revelation. That's when that was written. Was while he was in exile there. By the way, there is a story that was told by Tertullian. I guess it was a common. It was commonly circulated that John was boiled in oil and survived. But from what I can see, I don't know if that's actually a true story or if that's one of those legend kind of a things. It's possible that that didn't really happen. According to Irenaeus and Clement, who lived, you know, closer to that time than Tertullian did. After Patmos, John actually went back to Ephesus to go and encourage the believers there. And that's where he ended up, I think that's where he ended up dying, you know, and he was the only disciple, as you guys know, that died of natural causes. But it's believed that he went back to Ephesus to continue in the ministry there and stuff. So, and there's some stories about him, like, bringing, you know, just again, bringing people to Christ and stuff while he was in, while he was there in that city. So, that was the second persecution. The third persecution under Trajan and Hadrian. Hadrian might be familiar to you guys because he was the guy who built Hadrian's Wall, right, between England and Scotland. Maybe you guys didn't know that. Anyway, moving on. Now you know.
Is Scotland
and Ireland? No, Ireland is. Well, it is Scotland and England, but it's all together. Oh. England and Scotland are connected. So there's like, yeah, there was like the old wall between them and stuff like that. So, and the Scots and the English, they've always like hated each other. And the Irish, they all, you know, everybody hates the English basically. So age old wounds. I tell you, it's pretty crazy over there. And, you know, I see some of that because my family lives in the UK. So it's interesting. Yeah, some of that stuff we just don't understand because America's so relatively young, like 200 years compared to a couple thousand years, you know, so we don't understand those old hatreds and rivalries and issues, so. Yes, that's right. Northern California always trying to secede, right? Aren't they trying to become their own state? So that's what Scotland's been trying to do. They're trying to become their own country. They had a vote for it this last year, and it actually was kind of close. So you never know. They might still do it. Anyway, that's completely irrelevant to the third persecution of the church. In 108, okay. So during this persecution, this is when Ignatius, one of the church fathers that we talked about a couple weeks ago, he was martyred at this time. Wasn't Ignatius, he was the one that had, remember he had the lions hanging off of him, you know, in that picture that looked very unrealistic as he's just calmly standing there with a lion ripping his arm off. Anyway, he was martyred along with approximately 10,000 other believers. So it was a pretty brutal persecution. Things got so bad during this time that even some of the Romans asked the emperor to kind of chill out a little bit. They were like, okay, that's enough. So that's saying something. After Hadrian, the emperor Antoninus Pius came to the throne, and he stopped persecuting the church during his reign. And so, as your book said, before the year 200, that was kind of the pattern of how persecution went for the church. It was very sporadic, it wasn't constant, and it was kind of just at the hands of a few really creepy emperors, basically, or governors. It wasn't necessarily all of them. There were some emperors that were very lax and very tolerant of the Christians, or at least they just didn't persecute them so outright. They were, you know, a little more easy on them, and Antoninus Pius was one of those. And so under him, the church entered a period of rest for about a generation or so, which is, you know, significant. And this was one of those many times of rest that were very helpful. But the only bad thing was that it caused the church to kind of let their guard down a little bit. And we talked about that last week, how the church began to let, you know, some complacency in and some compromise creep in. And it doesn't seem like, you know, when you look over just the course of all of history, one little generation, 40 to 50 years, it doesn't seem like that long of a time period. But, you know, all we have to do is think about how much has changed in the last 40 or 50 years here, right? And so, back in the 60s, you know? I mean, things have changed quite a bit since the 60s. And it's, you know, it actually is a significant amount of time, so much so that if you ask younger kids now who the Beatles are, they don't know who that is, and that just drives me crazy. But, you know, really, it's been long enough where they don't remember that stuff. Who are the Rolling Stones? I don't know. And, you know, I don't like the Stones anyway, but that's just my personal. Anyways, so, but the point is, a lot can happen in those 40 or 50 years. And so that makes sense. You can see how people would forget what it had been like under persecution. And they kind of just move on with life, you know, just like I said, like people today, you know, they forget who the Beatles were and, you know, like Martin Luther King and some of those key figures from the 60s, you know, they might not know any of that stuff anymore unless they, you know, hear about it in school. And so it was similar back then. People would have kind of just let the persecution fall by the wayside, or memory of the persecution would fall by the wayside.
Same thing in the book of Judges.
And yeah, there you go. People forget. Yeah, exactly. You know, God does this amazing thing, and then the next generation, they forget and go back to walking in their own ways again. It's just human nature, unfortunately. And that was also unfortunate because the Gnostics were really on the rise during the reign of Antoninus Pius, you know, in the early 100s there. That's when Gnosticism really began to flourish. And so the church needed to be on their game, you know, and really keep their guard up. And so, you know, that was, you know, fortunately the Lord did, like I said, raise up those guys that did kind of call the church to task. Like, come on, you guys, we need to get our act together. And of course, persecution picked up again, and that also got people's eyes opened. The fourth persecution of the church, in fact, was under Marcus Aurelius after Antoninus Pius. He came to the throne. 162 AD, he began a persecution of the church. And this one was so bad that even the people that were watching the torture of the Christians, because remember, the Romans were pretty, you know, the Roman public was pretty, you know, cruel and like bloodthirsty in a way. If you think about it, you know, they all go to the Colosseum and to the arena to watch, you know, animals killing each other and animals and men fighting. And then, you know, once the Christians start getting persecuted, they would just throw Christians out there into the arena to be tortured and killed by wild animals and stuff. And so you've got all these spectators watching this stuff, which is pretty weird. in my opinion, I'm just like, man, we think it's bad today. You know, at least we're all sitting around watching people murder each other, unless, well, except for the Hunger Games, but that is just a movie at this point. Who knows how long it'll be before that actually happens. But that's kind of, you know, that's what people were doing. And yet, even though, you know, the crowds were used to seeing Christians sent to the arena and being, you know, tortured and stuff like that, it got so bad during the reign of Marcus Aurelius that even the spectators were kind of grossed out by what they were seeing, where they were kind of like, ooh, we don't want it. That's a little too much carnage, a little too much blood. So that shows how, like, again, how violent and how cruel some of this was. There's actually many stories that were recorded from this time period, so I want to share a couple of these. So let's kind of zoom in on a couple specific stories. I think the most appropriate one to begin with is the story of Polycarp, and I mentioned him last week. You guys also, I think, read about him in your book. There's a little, you know, brief snippet of his story. He was actually martyred in the year 155, not, you know, so he was before Marcus Aurelius came to the throne, but I just kind of lumped it in with this persecution because, date-wise, that was the closest one. The story of Polycarp's martyrdom is actually one of the most well-documented accounts that we have from ancient times, which is pretty remarkable. I think it was originally recorded by Irenaeus, one of the church fathers we talked about last week, because he was one of Polycarp's disciples. And so, you know, he loved this guy and he, you know, faithfully recorded everything that happened. And then that account was passed down by the Church of Smyrna and other copyists. So many other accounts of martyrdoms grew out of, you know, legend and became really exaggerated beyond the original circumstances. So that's what makes the account of Polycarp so significant and important to talk about, is because this one is actually, you know, legit. We know it can be verified by eyewitnesses that this is what happened. It wasn't just somebody like creating some legend about, you know, a dragon and a, you know, whatever else that came on the scene. You know, because there were a lot of crazy stories that went on, but this one was pretty legit. So Polycarp, interestingly enough, was the bishop of Smyrna in the mid-100s. So very fitting with the application to this passage in Revelation. He was the last living person to receive personal discipleship from one of the 12 apostles, because he sat under the apostle John. And again, he passed on his authority, I guess you could say, to Irenaeus and into future generations. But I thought that was kind of neat. So the last living person to have contact with one of the apostles. And so, you know, who knows? Maybe he encouraged his congregation at Smyrna concerning their trials and tribulations from this very letter, you know? Because since he was so tightly connected to John, I'm sure he must have, you know, received this once John wrote it all out and had it circulating, had the book of Revelation circulating in the churches. It would not be surprising if, you know, to find out that that was indeed the case, that he read this snippet to the Church of Smyrna, to his own congregation at that time. So it's kind of neat. Again, brings the Bible to life when you tie these things together. It's really kind of remarkable. Yeah, so Polycarp was a great leader in the church. He was a real defender of the faith against Gnosticism, as well as the teachings of Marcion. I don't know if you guys read about Marcion. Did you? Yeah, the guy. Okay, so in case you can't remember, he's the guy who tried to rewrite Christianity, basically, by rejecting the Old Testament God.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he just liked the God of love, right? The God of the Apostle Paul. And so he just... Yeah, yeah. So he just... He was, yeah, kind of trying to rework it his own way. And so Polycarp came in, he said, I don't think so. And so he stepped in, and he was a really strong voice in the early church era in dealing with heresy. He also authored several epistles to the Philippian church as well. So, again, he was a real key, you know, church father, I guess you could say, during that time, and a real leader. And so when persecution broke out in the area, the authorities obviously came looking for him. People knew that he was an important leader, that he had a lot of influence, that he had, you know, been under John and everything. And so he was pretty well known and well venerated in that area. And so the authorities come looking for him. By this time, he was like an 86-year-old man. So he's like this old guy by now, but they still were like, well, we want to make an example out of him because he is such a leader and such an influence. And so his friends convinced him to leave the city and go hide in a farmhouse. And during this time, the Church of Smyrna wrote that, quote, while praying, he fell into a trance 3 days before his capture, and he saw his pillow burning with fire. And he turned and said to those that were with him, it must be that I shall be burned alive. So it was like the Lord gave him kind of a, you know, preparation, really, for what lay ahead. And so the Roman authorities pursued him to another place. He kind of just kept trying to stay ahead of them, hiding out in different places. And then at one point, wherever, I can't remember where he was hiding out. I think he was probably like on a farm or something like that. And Polycarp could see, you know, the Roman soldiers come up and start interrogating this young boy, and they started torturing him to reveal where Polycarp was. And at that point, Polycarp was like, oh, I can't let this happen to that kid. And so he came out of hiding. He's like, okay, here I am. I'll just give myself up right now. I can't let you do that to this boy. And so he basically just said, you know, the will of God be done. Whatever's going to happen, you know, God's in control and he knows what he's doing. And so he, like I said, he came out, he talked to the authorities, and then he ordered a meal to be prepared for them. I mean, he really just, you know, kind of went the extra mile to love his enemies here at this point. I mean, talk about taking that literally. And so while they ate, he prayed. He just sat in the corner and prayed. And he was just praying so fervently for these guys that a lot of them who came, you know, to arrest him, they started feeling guilty. They're sitting there eating their food and watching this nice old man pray. I don't know if he was praying out loud, Lord, and bless the soldier on the left, and I pray for his family and his wife, and, you know, I don't know. Who knows what he was doing, but the guys really started to feel like, what are we doing here? This is like an old man, and we're going to take him, drag him away before the, you know, before the court. I don't know if this is a good idea. So, again, it kind of just reminded me of Titus 2 when it talks about, you know, conducting yourself in such a way that that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. That's exactly what happened, you know. I mean, they were ashamed that they were coming and doing this to somebody that was showing them nothing but kindness and love and the love of Jesus. And so, however, they had to carry out their orders, and so he was put under arrest, he was taken away, brought to trial. And the Roman official in charge of his case, you know, just like those soldiers, he actually felt sorry for this old man who was being dragged in front of him. In fact, I can imagine that this Roman official was kind of like, oh no, seriously, I have to put this guy on trial. I wouldn't want to do that. Take some sweet little grandpa. You know, it was a pretty, you know, pretty low blow, a pretty low thing to do. And so he's, you know, so this Roman official, he did everything he could to get Polycarp to deny his faith because he wanted kind of an out. You know, he's like, I don't want to have to torture or hurt you. I don't want to have to kill you. Why don't you just deny your faith and go home and live out the rest of your days with your grandchildren? You know, just go and enjoy the rest of your life. And when he urged Polycarp to deny his faith, Polycarp replied, 86 years have I served Christ, nor has he ever done me any harm. How then can I blaspheme my king who saved me? You threaten the fire that burns for an hour and then is quenched, but you know not of the fire of judgment to come and the fire of eternal punishment. Bring what you will. In other words, bring it on, right? I mean, what a testimony. I mean, he just was like, firm to the end. He's like, what?
I'll burn for an hour and that's about it.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, it's like, gosh, I mean, what is, you know, God has been so faithful to me. Why would I deny him now in my last day, you know? And it reminds me of what David said in Psalm 37 when he said, I've been young and now I'm old, but I've not seen the righteous forsaken or his descendants begging bread. That was the same testimony Polycarp had. He's like, God's been so faithful to me. How could I deny him? You know, yeah, like I said, that's like, it's an hour of burning and then I'll be in glory. So bring it on. So when they've tried to pressure him again, he said, since you are vainly urgent, as you say, that I should swear by the fortune of Caesar and pretend not to know who and what I am, hear me declare with boldness that I am a Christian. And if you wish to learn the doctrines of Christianity, appoint me a day and you shall hear them. So pretty bold words. He's like, hey, if you want to hear more, let me know and we'll set a date on the calendar. I've got my day timer here. I'll put you in. I mean, he just, you know, held nothing back. And so as he himself had prophesied, he was sent to be burned at the stake. And as the fire began to burn, he prayed, and this was documented by those who were eyewitnesses of the whole thing. O Lord God Almighty, the Father of thy beloved and blessed Son, Jesus Christ, by whom we have received the knowledge of thee, the God of angels and powers and every creature and the whole race of the righteous who live before thee, I give thee thanks that thou hast counted me worthy of this day and this hour, that I should have a part in the number of thy martyrs. And I mention this because this is a very prevalent theme we see in the lives of the martyrs, the fact that they considered it such a high calling to give their lives for Jesus. A lot of times they would say this, that they were thankful to be counted worthy. You know, this was something that they, I mean, not that everybody was like dying to do, no pun intended, well, pun intended. They're like longing to die a horrible, cruel death, but there was a sense where they just saw the honor and the privilege that, wow, Lord, you're entrusting this to me. That I can give my life for you in this way. What an honor. And sometimes, though, there were those who were upset if they thought they weren't going to be martyred. I mean, this was a big deal to get the martyrs. Yeah, to get the martyr's crown. I mean, that was like, you know, that was like the thing back then. It's amazing, you know. What a perspective these guys had. It's pretty mind-blowing. Now, the miraculous thing, what?
I just told a girl today, she's going on a mission trip in Nicaragua and sick right now.
Oh.
I was like, what a great, how great it is, our hope is to die in serving God. How great would that be?
I'm sure she'll like, thank you. Yeah, okay.
Yes.
That's awesome.
She and her mom were both like, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Now, the miraculous thing is that the fire didn't actually burn Polycarp. A lot of people said that were watching, they said it looked more like bread being baked in an oven than actual flesh burning. I don't know what that looked like, if he just turned brown or something and got tan. I don't know, but he looked like bread was being baked. And then there's this, instead of the smell of burning flesh, which is disgusting, there was this sweet fragrance, kind of like frankincense, that was coming out of the fire. So, I mean, this really remarkable stuff was happening. And this did happen from time to time. Like I said, there were stories that got exaggerated, blown out of proportion. But this did happen on occasion where, it was like a power, just this extra, testimony of the miraculous, what God was doing. What? Hey, exactly. So when the Romans realized that he was not going to die in the fire, they're like, oh my gosh, this guy's just kind of tanning in there. Someone came in and pierced him with a sword, and so much blood gushed out that it put the flames out. It just completely sapped the fire and it went out. So it was like, whoa. The whole thing, like I said, was just this miraculous experience and testament of the power of God, really. And so, everybody, I think, was kind of in awe, wow, how did that happen right now? So crazy stuff, but very cool, again, that this old saint who had glorified God in life glorified him in death as well. And like I said, I told that story at great length, partly because it's a very important, well-documented account, but there were also a lot of other people that were martyred during this time, including Justin Martyr, who I talked about last week. He was a couple weeks ago, that apologetics guy, one of the early apologists of the faith, who we've talked about. Also, I think I mentioned to you guys, Carthage was a site of a lot of persecution. You won't remember I said that, but I do remember telling you guys that the first class when we were looking at all the key early church sites. Carthage experienced a lot of persecution. In the year 180, there were 12 Christians banded together and martyred at that time in the city center. We also have from an unknown source an account of the martyrs in Lyon, which was one of those other major cities in the early church. I think I told you guys Lyon would have been kind of like an outpost, really, because that would have been in central France, kind of farther away from the Mediterranean, where a lot of the churches were thriving in the early days. But it was a significant church nonetheless. And so in the year 177, there were a lot of martyrs in that particular region. And so during that wave of persecution in Gaul, which again is present-day France, the Christians in Lyon and the nearby town of Vienne, they were excluded from all public places. They were taken and beaten by angry mobs. False accusations were being made against the Christians, as usual, concerning cannibalism, concerning incest, all kinds of things. In fact, the author of the account said, some of the accusations were unlawful for us either to mention or even think of. Just some really gross and dark, evil accusations that were made against the Christians. And so because of such horrible allegations, the Romans were even more eager to obliterate the Christians, because they're like, well, gosh, if these things are true, which they weren't, but if these things are true, then we need to get rid of them. We can't let these Christians live. They're just a blemish on society. These people are just so evil and gross. And so the author of the account says, so was fulfilled what was spoken by our Lord. The time shall come when everyone who slays you shall think that he is offering service to God. So if you remember that scripture, I was like, wow, what a perfect picture of that. Because a lot of these Romans did think that, as they were fed all of these lies and false accusations against the Christians and believed it. They started to kind of feel like, well, gosh, we're going to be doing everybody a service if we get rid of the Christians, because these guys are going to do nothing but create problems in society if we let them live. And so, again, it's kind of like when Saul was persecuting the Christians, right? The Apostle Paul, before he was saved, He thought he was serving God too. He thought the Christians were a horrible affront to the Jewish faith, and that God definitely wasn't pleased with them, and so he thought he was doing God a favor. That's what a lot of the Romans started to think whenever these allegations came up against Christians. So it's kind of interesting to see, like, okay, well, you can see why they felt like they needed to kill them and why they needed to be so cruel and vicious towards Christians. Again, we see once more how so much of the New Testament writings come to life when you consider the context here. I know for me, even like studying the martyrs and stuff like that, it really helped me understand books like 1 Peter, 1 and 2 Thessalonians a lot better, because those deal so much with persecution and trials and how to handle those things. And because that's exactly what these people were going through. And so, it just gives greater perspective. Hopefully the next time you guys read those epistles, you know, you'll see that in a new light, considering what was going on. So it wasn't long before, that's all right. We'll take a break in a second here. I just want to finish the fourth persecution here. There was a lot that happened. It wasn't long before these Christians were made to undergo all kinds of trials and tortures. It wasn't just allegations and people saying bad things about them. Pretty soon, like I said, the Romans were a lot more aggressive in trying to get rid of them. And so there was a deacon of the church in Vienne, that town that was near to Lyon, and his name was Sanctus. He went through some of the most disgusting stuff. His church historian Eusebius tells us that when he was brought to trial, no matter what they asked him, no matter what they said to him, his only reply was, "I am a Christian." No matter what they said to him, he just kept saying, "I'm a Christian, I'm a Christian, I'm a Christian, I'm a Christian." Yeah, exactly. He just kept saying it over and over again. And so they put him through some really horrible stuff. They tried the initial round of tortures on him, like, you know, whipping him and scourging and stuff like that. And that didn't work. And so they thought, like, well, I guess we got to, you know, crank it up a notch. And so they took these red hot black brass plates and stuck them all over, like, the delicate parts of his body. So you can imagine, like, all over the sensitive areas of his body. They just stuck these plates of brass on him. Later, they put him in a hot iron chair to be roasted alive, basically. And in the end, the author says, he was refreshed and strengthened by the heavenly fountain of the water of life, but his body bore witness to what had happened. It was all wounds and welts, shrunken and torn up. It had externally lost the human shape. Can you imagine that you don't even look human anymore because you're just so so burned and beat up and battered? It was just like disgusting, disgusting stuff. But that's the kind of things that these people had to face. And so the bishop of Lyon was also martyred at this time. His name was Pothinus. He was over 90 years old. So like Polycarp, they thought if we can get some of these old guys that are the leaders and the great influences, that'll put out the faith. And so they didn't, you know, in the end, they would kill even the oldest of men and not have no respect for age or anything like that. The neat thing was, though, like Polycarp, he stayed strong in his convictions and in his faith to the end. One more story, and then we'll take a break. We have to take a break because I don't have any water, and I'm starting to die here. the story of Brent. Is there one over there?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
How come I can't see it? Oh, in the box? Okay, I'll get one. The story of Blendina, this girl right here.
The one that's got one of the best stories in the Foxbrook of Martyrs.
Oh, yeah, like with all the details?
And her story by far was my favorite.
Really? Oh, that's cool. Yep. So, again, another plug there for Fox's Book of Martyrs, folks. But here's like the brief version. But yeah, it's neat because Fox kind of gets into more of the details and stuff like that. And he just writes really well. So Blendina was a slave woman. She was actually physically very weak, but her faith was really strong. And so the people, you know, just looking at her, you know, her fellow Christians, they were kind of afraid for her when they all got arrested. They thought, gosh, I don't know if Blendina's going to make it, man. I don't think she'll, you know, she might end up denying the faith because I don't know how physically she can put up with any of these tortures and these things that, you know, they do to us. But what happened was, is they were all, you know, like I said, rounded up and awaiting, you know, being called in to be questioned and interrogated and then tortured. As they were waiting, one of the other Christians there in the group, he started to kind of freak out and get scared. And he was afraid that he wasn't going to be able to confess Christ, especially if the persecution got really intense. And it was like the Holy Spirit came on Blendina or something. She suddenly became super bold and strong. She's like, "No way, man, we're going to stand for Jesus. We're all going to do this." And so when they went out into the, you know, arena for their initial torture, she was, you know, whipped and, you know, flogged and all that sort of a thing. And they kind of just, the torturer guys, they kind of gave up on her because she was just so firm in her faith and everything. And all the other Christians who saw this were like, go Brandina. They're all stoked. They're like, oh my gosh, she's like the weakest of us.
They couldn't kill her.
Yeah, they couldn't get her. It was crazy. So, I mean, they kind of gave up for the time being. They're like, okay, we'll come back to you later. And so they put everybody back in prison, and then the time came for the games. Because that's what would happen. There were times where Christians would, go be on trial or be tortured or executed or whatever, just in isolated instances. But there were other times where they would all be, kind of corralled together and brought into the arena for, like, a show, for the Roman public to come and watch. And so when the games began and she was called out into the arena, she was suspended on a post in the crucifix position. And she was just basically just there as food for some lions and wild animals that were going to be let out. But she just, kind of hung there, suspended on the post, and just kept praying. And she was such an example to all of the other Christians around her. And the author of the account said, as they saw her, their sister, they contemplated him that was crucified for them, that he might persuade those that believe in him that everyone who suffers for Christ will forever enjoy communion with the living God. So as they saw her suspended out there on like a crucifix, it just reminded them of Jesus and of, what he had done for them. And it totally rallied everyone and encouraged their faith. So as she's out there, all of these lions come out, and as you can see, this was an action photo of what had happened out there. They didn't touch her. I don't know what happened to the crucifix she's supposed to be on, but anyway, they didn't touch her. And these are, you guys probably know what they would do if they were going to have the games and stuff with the wild animals. They would starve them for a few days so that they'd be really hungry and go out in the arena and just, go and slaughter everybody, anything that moved. But they came out, and they just kind of cruised around, walked around her. Nice kitty, right? So they were just very calm and docile, just like Daniel in the lion's den, basically. And so, what?
Boomtown.
Yes. And so they sent her back to prison. It was kind of embarrassing, like, oh my gosh, what just happened? So they're like, okay, nothing to see here, folks. They brought her back into the prison. And when she was again, for the third time, sent out to be tortured, one historian says she went to the arena with joy and exultation at the issue, as if she were invited to a marriage feast and not to be cast before the wild beasts. So they, at this point, they scourged her again. They threw her, out there before the wild animals. Then they took one of those iron chair things and they roasted her alive in it. And then they threw her in front of a angry bull, at which time, the bull gored her to death and she died. But she had been such an example and a comfort to all of the other martyrs that were with her, all of the other Christians that were with her during that time. She ended up being the last one to, last one to die. She kind of, like I said, she served as kind of an example to them to kind of keep their faith strong. And so they all died for their faith. And then she went on last and was said to have died, quote, sending them on before her as victors to the great king. So I think that's sweet that, again, the weak are made strong in the Lord, and that's a perfect example of that. God took the weakest out of the group, and he used her as the strongest example to the rest of the believers at that time. Pretty sweet. So at the death of, like you said, they couldn't kill her until it was time, until God said, okay, now it's time. I'll take you home now. At the death of Marcus Aurelius, there was a change in the rule of Rome. It wasn't just those of Roman culture and background who were emperors, but there were foreigners that would become emperor as well, because the empire was becoming more and more diverse as more and more people groups were taken over. And so that's going to affect the way the persecution went as well. So I'm so sorry. Let's take a break now. That went a little bit long. I know. You guys are like dying. But it means we have less to cover when we get back. Should I turn this off for now? Or?
I think it was Darcyan
Marcion? Okay, I was like, Darcyan. I was like, Darcy, like Mr. Darcy in Pride and Prejudice? I was like, are you going to go there? I'll go there, but I don't know if you want to.
So, Marcion, I actually wrote this in the homework, but Marcion, that was super interesting because he rejected Matthew, Mark, Acts, and Hebrews, but Luke was the one of the Gospels he accepted, except for, like, the whole thing, whatever. But Acts was the continuation of Luke's book to Theophilus. I thought, what was his deal about that?
What, his deal with the book of Acts and stuff like that?
It's the same thing.
I know, you would think, huh? Like, it's just a sequel? I don't know. I mean, all I can think of was because he was all about the God of Love thing. Maybe he didn't like Ananias and Sapphira getting fried and, you know, stuff like that. I mean, because that was his main thing, was like, God is a God of love, not like the Old Testament judging God, you know. And
but
so
he kept Romans.
Whoa, sorry.
He kept
Romans. Interesting. Romans,
yeah, like, I was like, what is this deal? Like,
he's just, yeah, it's so... Yeah, once you start...
Seriously,
chapter one, and it's like, boom, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I was like, what? Like, he doesn't... Sideways.
Yeah, that is really.
I've only read the first couple chapters of Romans. That's why.
You know,
the first chapter talks about.
Those are the judge. Yeah.
The first chapter.
The right hand of his God is revealed against. Yeah, it's like.
9 and 11 must have been out the because that's all I can deal with. But
you know, once you start cutting, you can just like you're just it's so willy nilly. I guess I'll cut this, and I don't want this part. You know, it's like so arbitrary.
When someone's mother's like anti-Semitic as well. That's not what the book
is. Yeah, he cut out Old Testament.
Yeah, Old Testament for sure.
Because he thought it was for the Jews, and he didn't like. So, right.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, as long as the wrath of God is maybe on the Jews and not us or something like
well,
that.
Well, even the God in the Old Testament was mean. He was evil. Who?
Yeah.
You know, there are some things, and, you know, God the first books, and, you know, about Joshua, you know. Like,
yeah, I mean, some sobering stuff there going on, so.
Sick.
I'd love to see that as an action movie, huh?
I was like, what? Like, why? What was him? I don't know.
Was with him? Yeah, I don't
know. Like, no, like, what was he? Like, he was just not that you have
any.
Marcion, I mean, I just know the basics like you guys do, but yeah, he was just, I don't know, some of these guys. You know, and these guys, it's like church era, you know, I mean, it's all new and people are coming up with all kinds of things that now we might be like, what? But, you know. I mean, some of those ideas, they just get thrown around. And then, you know, as we talked about, some of it gets repackaged and comes back later. You know, there's still people that think, like, well, there must be two different gods, the God in the Old Testament and the New Testament, you know, because they don't look carefully and don't consider the whole counsel of God, you know. It's easy to look at it that way, so.
That whole movement, I forgot the name of it, where it said that Jesus was a man and he wasn't God until he fulfilled the law.
Yeah.
And so it kind of goes into
the... Oh, yeah.
No, movement.
Yeah.
Today people say, well, Jesus was a good teacher. He wasn't a God, but he's a good, smart teacher.
Yeah, so yeah. Same kind of mentality. Oh, totally. Just a different package. Exactly.
It's crazy because I'll read the book to my wife because that's the only thing that, like, that's, like, my only focus. I'm like, okay, I got to read this to you because I'm not going to do it later. And she starts, like, listening to me, and she was raised Catholic her whole life. And so she just accepted the Lord, like, I want to say almost 2 years ago.
Wow.
She went to Catholic school. Her whole family's Catholic. We had a big ordeal with her family.
Yeah, I bet.
We didn't want to get married in a Catholic church.
Yeah.
It was crazy. So everything that I'm reading her, she's just like flashing back, and she's like, the Holy Spirit's totally talking to me right now. She's like, that's
sweet.
Totally the Catholic church. She's like, all this stuff, and she's just telling me all these things, and I'm like, honey? I was like, oh, yeah, I forgot. You were like Catholic your whole entire life. So she's telling me all these things, and... Like, right before, like, I'll start, like, this summary, she's like, oh, they're going to start talking about this and this and this and this. And I'm like, whoa. I'm like, how do you know that? How do you read this book? And she's like, no. She's
yeah,
like,
she just knows. Crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's awesome. Yeah. Oh, that's rad. Well, hey, I'm glad, you know, it's benefiting her, too. That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's really sweet.
A quick note.
Yes.
I was watching 60 Minutes of the day. They're talking about Iraq and ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
They just took over monks are, you know, one
yeah,
of the oldest monasteries
mm-hmm.
in the world.
Yeah.
One of the oldest one, and it had scriptures from the first century that ISIS got a hold of, and they're probably going to burn them all.
Oh.
They said that
original
manuscripts
yeah.
from the first and second century that, you know, that they had to leave. They could only take
yeah.
so much when they had to leave, and ISIS has them.
Tragic.
Well, those are only material objects that
yeah.
we have in here. And
yeah, well, fortunately, we have, yeah.
The Lord's instilled in our hearts.
Yeah. So. I mean, thank God it's now and not back in the day when, like, yeah. those were the only copies that, you know, everybody had. Like, yeah, that's, man.
Yeah, they've seen a lot of them. They were never seen by the whole public. They've only been in the monastery.
Oh, wow.
They have never been shared. And
wow.
So stuff that, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of
prayer needed notice.
A lot of Muslims are turning on their faith because of ISIS. Like, they don't want it. This is what Muslim
awesome
Muslim is
backfiring.
They don't want to be a part of it. So.
Excellent. It's backfiring on him. I got to share the Lord once with a guy that was like that. He was like, I don't know, man. I feel like Muhammad and this whole thing is just too violent. You know, he was just really questioning and searching. And he was full on from, you know, Iran and, whatever. I can't remember if he was a Sunni or a... Anyway. But yeah, no, that's really cool. It's like, I love that. The enemy overreaches himself a lot of times. All right. Let's go ahead and crank it up. You already turned it on, didn't you? Oh, well, we'll get a lot of good discussion here on the recording. You guys can go back and listen and remember. Wow, that was a fun time. Okay. that's at the side. Okay. On to the fifth persecution under Septimus Severus in 192. Now, Severus was different because initially he did not have a problem with the Christian faith. He actually kind of favored Christians in the beginning, but he had a lot of bad counsel around him, and so what happened was he allowed peer pressure to get the better of him, and so he had a change of heart. He allowed other, again, all of the bad influences around him, those that didn't like the Christians, those that were suspicious of the Christians, to affect him, and so he, changed his course, changed policy, and allowed persecution of the Christians to continue. In fact, he actually put in place the first law against Christianity in 202. Interesting, you would think, well, wasn't there already a law against Christianity? No, not necessarily. It was just kind of a number. Everybody, it was just a general persecution and general policy that, Christians are the scapegoats if something goes wrong. But he was the first person to actually, write out an edict and say Christianity is now illegal. And so he forbade anyone from converting to the faith. At this time, persecution was still somewhat localized, however, and actually most of the persecution took place in Africa because that's where Severus was from. Remember what I said before the break, that after Marcus Aurelius, there were a lot of different kinds of emperors that came to the throne. It was more because the empire was so diversified, you have other nationalities and other peoples intermixing, with the Romans, and then they would come to the throne eventually. So Severus was African, North African, I would probably guess. And so persecution mostly took place where he was from. And yet, in spite of this, this is what Fox wrote. Listen to this great quote. I like this. During this time, he said, "Though persecuting malice raged, yet the gospel shone with resplendent brightness, and firm as an impregnable rock, withstood the attacks of boisterous enemies with success." Tertullian, who lived in this age, informs us that if the Christians had collectively withdrawn themselves from the Roman territories, the empire would have been greatly depopulated. Isn't that amazing? Not only were they not able to stomp the Christians out, but they were increasing so much that, it would have been noticeable if all of the Christians were gone. If they had, all evacuated or escaped or something like that, the Roman Empire would have been greatly depopulated. That's how many people were converting to the faith at this point. So really remarkable, the influence Christianity had. Whenever the fires turned up, it was like it just caused it to spread that much more. So during this time, many gave their lives for the gospel, as Fox describes. A few of these include Leonidas, who was Origen's father. The church father Irenaeus died during this time. Remember, Ignatius died a couple persecutions back. Irenaeus died at this time, as well as a guy named Alban. I always think of Alvin and the Chipmunks, but it's not, A-L-B-A-N. He's considered the first martyr from Britain. I'm not going to tell his story because a lot of it was kind of like fabricated into a legend and all that sort of thing. But we do know that he was documented as one of the first, if not the first, martyr from Britain. But the best documented of the martyrdoms during this time concerns a well-bred, educated woman from Carthage named Perpetua and her slave girl Felicitas. So this is kind of like Polycarp's account. Remember I said that Polycarp's martyrdom is one of those really well-documented accounts that we have from ancient times. Perpetua's account is also very legit. And so I wanted to take a minute and talk about her story. And again, remember Septimus Severus's persecution was in Africa, and that's where these gals were from. And so this is actually her account of, the account of her martyrdom is one of the prized possessions of the early church. It's probably the only account that is actually autobiographical. Polycarp's account was written by eyewitnesses, but Perpetua actually wrote out a lot of what happened. It's almost like her diary up until the time of her martyrdom. And it's also, of course, the earliest document that we have from a Christian woman. So there's a lot of reasons why this is a really significant document that we have. And so I wanted to give some of these details here. Perpetua was a young 22-year-old mom. She had a baby boy at the time of her arrest. And like I said, she gives us kind of her dear diary, a detailed account of her imprisonment all the way up to the point of her death. And then other believers who were eyewitnesses, they ended up filling in the rest of the details of what happened to her. Kind of like what happened with Polycarp. You know, those that saw it, they wrote out the account. And that's what happened when she actually went to her execution. So when she was originally arrested, her father came and tried to persuade her to deny her faith. And that was, I think, one of the biggest challenges she had. If you read her story and everything, one of the biggest struggles she had was dealing with her dad constantly trying to come and persuade her to deny her faith. You know, based on family ties, that would make it very, very difficult. And so she had this conversation with him that she wrote out. She said, "Father, do you see this vessel lying here?" And he said, "I see it." And I said to him, "Can it be called by any other name than its own?" And he said, "Well, no. Nor can I call myself by anything else than what I am, a Christian." And so she just kept saying that sort of thing to him over and over again. Like, "I can't deny who I am, Dad. I can't, you know, I can't turn my back on the Lord." And so her dad tried over and over again to convince her to deny Christ and come home to her family, you know, for the sake of her baby, you know, pulling all of those heartstrings and everything. And yet she stayed firm. When she originally was sent to prison, she was actually separated from her baby, and so she was actually, that was what distressed her more than anything else. But pretty soon they brought the baby to her in order to nurse, and from that time on, she said, "My prison suddenly became a palace, so that I preferred being there to being anywhere else." Pretty amazing. And one writer made this comment, and I think this is very insightful. Perpetua demonstrated how, for a believer, external conditions in the final analysis are not as important as our attitude towards them. Isn't that so true? It's like external conditions are not as important as our attitude towards them. Because there's so many things we can do nothing about, you know, in life and circumstances and situations, whatever might come up, you know. Or there's things that, you know, we just, I don't know, we make a decision, these things happen. And so if in the midst of all of those things, really our attitude towards those situations is really the only thing that we can do anything about, right? The only thing that we can change. And so I think, like, wow, that's such an amazing perspective that she had, you know, to take her external surroundings and say, you know, I'm going to just have this perspective towards them. And so while in prison, you know, we see that over and over with the martyrs. They had such perspective and such an amazing attitude towards their situation. So while she was in prison, she had a vision, after which she said, "I told my brother," meaning her brother in the Lord, I think. You know, it was just somebody else who was in prison with her. "And we understood that our passion was imminent and we ceased to have any more hope in this world." Kind of like what happened to Polycarp, you know. The Lord sometimes would give these guys visions or dreams and kind of prepare them, you know, emotionally, spiritually, for what was going to come. Soon after this, the whole group of Christians that Perpetua had been arrested with, they were all brought forward for questioning. They all confessed their faith. They all confessed themselves to be Christians. And when Perpetua's turn came, you know, she comes up to the little stand in front of the Roman official to make her stand, to state her case. And her dad comes running in. And, you know, this would have been, you know, I mean, kind of improper thing to do, but it shows just how desperate he was for her not to, you know, in his mind, throw her life away. And so he comes running in, breaks through, comes on his knees, and just starts begging her to please, you know, just deny the faith. Just sacrifice to the emperor, at least. You can be a Christian, whatever, but just sacrifice to the emperor. You know, think of your child, think of me and your mother, your family. I mean, he was just like I said, pulling out all the stops. And it would have been so difficult. And I can say this, too, because I'm a girl. I know emotionally how hard that would be, how, you know, intensely difficult that would be to, like, shut down your dad who's, like, on his knees in front of you. I mean, it would just be really hard. You would feel like the most hard-hearted person ever. And yet she resisted. And she's like, "I'm sorry. I can't do that." And so, I mean, she made the tough choice and she still stuck to her guns and professed her faith. But, man, with so much pressure, it was a very difficult decision. So she and the others, they were put back in prison for a little while longer, at which time their jailer actually had pity on them and let friends come and visit and bring them food and bring them things. That happened all the time. I'm sure you guys can imagine a lot of jailers, a lot of soldiers ended up getting saved just watching the, you know, the lives and testimonies of these people before them. And so This particular jailer was very merciful. Also, Perpetua's slave Felicitas, I haven't mentioned her that much yet, she gave birth to a daughter while she was there in prison. And so they took the baby and gave her to Felicitas' sister. And I presume that's what happened to Perpetua's baby as well, that he was given, you know, back to the family, probably to her dad or something like that. So Perpetua's account continues on up until the day before the games, in which they were supposed to be sent out to the arena and killed by wild beasts, of course. And from there, others picked up the narrative, and some even think that Tertullian might have been an eyewitness to this martyrdom and wrote down her account. Remember, he got saved as a result of witnessing the martyrs. And it's possible that, who knows, it could have been Perpetua's martyrdom that led him to Christ. We don't know, but some people think that he's the one that documented the account of her death. So the day of the event, they were marched out into the amphitheater, men first, and Perpetua and Felicitas being the only women, they were marched out last. And eyewitnesses said that they went joyfully as though they were on their way to heaven. And as they passed by the Roman official, his name was Hilarianus, they called out to him and said, you may be our judge, but God is yours. So, I mean, they were like right up to the end. They're like, just like was it Polycarp who said that, you know, you threatened the fire that lasts for an hour, but there's there's something a little, stronger coming down the pike after that. So, you know, they were very, very bold and confident. Taken out into the arena, Perpetua and Felicitas, you know, in order to, you know, demoralize and humiliate them, they were stripped, you know, they took all their clothes off. But the crowd didn't like that because, you know, Felicitas had just had a baby. It was just like, come on, guys. It was just really inhumane. It was gross. And so, fortunately, they, you know, ordered them to be sent back and put in, like, some sackcloth or something like that. And then they were taken back out into the arena. And then this is weird. They were exposed to a savage cow. That's what it says in the text. I'm like, a cow? I don't know how savage. Unless it hadn't been milked in like 5 days. It was like, you know, freaking out, maybe. And you just milk them to death. I don't know what happened. But anyways, the cow didn't kill them, which I'm not surprised by. It's like, they must have had, I don't know, maybe there was a budget cut and they couldn't get a bull to come in and, I don't know, or lions. So anyways, the cow didn't work. So eventually they just sent a gladiator out there to kill the women. But in Perpetua's case, the gladiator came, and he was really young and inexperienced. He'd never done this before. And so he actually, like, wounded her because he's, like, shaking. He didn't know what he was doing, and he, like, stabbed her in the wrong place. And so she's just, like, you know, kind of lying there, like, in pain. And so she actually took the blade and guided it to her own throat to help him to just get the job over with. It was like, oh, my gosh. That is nuts, you know? That. I mean, really, I mean, that'd be one thing for a man to do. I mean, that would be hard enough for a guy to do, let alone a woman, to, like, just, you know, have that kind of, I don't know, that's kind of guts. And so Tertullian said, perhaps so great a woman could not have been killed had she not herself been willing, you know, willing to be dispatched, as he put in Old English terms. Interestingly, Augustine later noted that the names of these two women, Perpetua and Felicitas, in the Latin, does anybody anyone want to venture a guess what those two mean? Perpetua sounds like our word perpetual. Okay, and in Latin it actually means everlasting. And Felicitas? Yeah. Huh? No, yes. Happy. Yep. Yeah, feliz. Uh-huh, that's right, exactly. So it's like the Latin, that's the Latin for happiness. And so their names, when you put them together, they translate everlasting happiness. So it's kind of like, oh, cool, because that's exactly what happened to them after they died. They, you know, they experienced everlasting happiness as they went to be with Jesus. And so, pretty gnarly story, you know. Encourage you guys, that's another account you can read. You know, you can probably find it even online, you know, in her own words, and just read the story as she tells it of her time in prison up until her martyrdom. So, really remarkable. So that leads us to the sixth persecution. Now, after the death of Severus, the Christians had another period of peace. And during this time, the emperors tolerated them. Some emperors even showed friendly interest in the Christians. It's like, wow, the Christianity stuck around this long. There must be something to this. So the number of Christians began to grow, as did their influence. And again, this would have been around probably the early 200s. C.P.S. Clark said, Christians began to buy sites and build churches instead of worshiping in private homes, and they gained some measure of popularity and fashion. Not always a good thing. It was actually thought during this time that the number of Christians doubled around the empire. And again, in some ways that's good. Of course, it's, you know, what a blessing to have peace and to not be constantly having to look over your shoulder in case you get your head chopped off. But the church at this time, this was when we start seeing the church become a little bit more of an organization, like we talked about last week, when we start seeing it prosper a little bit and get their eyes off of things that mattered, like sharing the gospel, the Great Commission, you know, and they get more focused on, you know, buildings and sites and getting land and property and stuff like that. So the church began to get a little soft as they became popular, unfortunately. And Clark makes a great point here. He says, the church had peace for 37 years since the death of Severus. 37 years seems a short time as we read of it, but it meant that no Christian under the age of 40 knew anything about persecution except by hearsay. No doubt they looked on persecution as a thing of the past. The church was therefore like the dragnet, full of all sorts of fishes, bad as well as good, much as it is today. Many, no doubt, were faithful. Many more only needed the trumpet call of persecution to rouse them from slumber. But many others were leading careless and worldly lives. That's a great description of the church's condition at this time. And it helps explain some of what I said last week. Remember, we talked about the church kind of falling into complacency here and there a little bit and letting their guard down. You know, that sort of thing happened during this time. And again, like I was saying before, 37 years doesn't sound like a long time until you realize, like, oh, that's true. That means anyone who was, you know, under 40, all they knew about persecution was what the old people said. And it seemed probably to them, you know, if you were living at that time, you would have thought, well, I guess we're not having that anymore. I guess everything's going to be fine. The emperor seems to like us. And so we'll probably never be persecuted again. So it'd be very easy to kind of just carry on and lose focus in some ways on what was important. So this season of peace lasted for a while, but there was a little bit of persecution in the middle. There was one brief little spot, and that was the sixth persecution under Maximinus in 235. He was the first emperor to actually single out the church leadership, the bishops and the elders, for martyrdom. During this time, there were many earthquakes in Asia, and people said, oh, we're neglecting the gods, that's why we're having these earthquakes. It must have to do with the Christians, because they're getting people to, you know, reject all of the gods. And so once that circulated, it just kind of fueled the anger of the masses against the Christians in that particular region. Like I said, this was still regional persecution, and so not everyone was experiencing this. But at that time, in that particular area of Asia where this took place, many Christians were killed without a trial. They were just thrown into piles and buried. I mean, they'd just be like lined up and like just slaughtered and shoved into a mass grave, basically. And that was something kind of new. That hadn't happened much before. But Maximinus was kind of a barbarian kind of, look at that guy. Me want food. You know, he looks like a thug, you know, kind of a thing. So anyway, he was kind of a barbarian kind of guy. So it's not surprising that he just kind of was like, let's just mow them all down. We don't need to give him a trial. So total disregard for the sanctity of life reminds me of another time in history. What do you think? Yeah, Holocaust, right? Just that mass, like, okay, line them up, kill them, shove them in the, you know, in that hole there. And so that's kind of what Maximinus did. But like I said, that was a brief little spot of persecution in an overall peaceful period until we get to the seventh persecution under Decius. This was a really gnar one in 249. The persecution of Decius really purged out all that worldliness that had been creeping into the church and kind of, you know, separated, I guess you could say, the sheep from the goats. Decius was a Roman general, and he really, you know, very, very patriotic, really wanted to bring back the glory of old Rome. And so, naturally, the Christians would be a great offense to his ideals because they wouldn't worship the emperor. He's like, how could you? You know, this is the great Roman Empire, and we need full unity, full cooperation. Let's get rid of these guys, and not just in my region. Let's do it everywhere. And so he initiated, like I said, the first empire-wide persecution of the church. And he systematically, this was a smart thing to do, he began with the church leadership and let the persecution trickle down to others. Because, you know, obviously you take out if you could take out the leaders, you have a better chance of weakening everybody else. You know, as they would get discouraged if they saw one of their leaders deny their faith. And so Decius' goal was that Christians would not necessarily become martyrs, but recant. You know, he really wanted them to deny their faith. I mean, some of these other emperors, they were fine with just, like I said, like Maximinus, just killing them all. But he's like, no, that's not as effective as if we can get them to deny their faith. That would really, again, discourage other Christians and maybe cause other people that were thinking of becoming a Christian to say, well, I guess it's not genuine. That person just denied it, so I guess it's not really the real deal to them. And so that was very smart. That would take the wind out of the Christian sails because, you know, martyrs obviously inspired people. As that was the track record that we see so far. Martyrs were constantly inspiring people, but apostates discouraged them, obviously. And so sadly, because the church had become kind of complacent and comfortable, a lot of people did recant. A lot of people did deny their faith, although there were many who stayed faithful as well. And so just to mention a few of those, there was one guy, Fabian, who was the bishop of Rome. Now, you got to imagine that the Roman Empire, or the Roman emperor, if he's going to start a persecution and he wants to target the church leadership, he's going to start in his city, in Rome, because that's the capital, right? That's the most influential. That's a place where everybody is looking to. And so the bishop at that particular time was a guy named Fabian. And so he was the first to be killed under Decius. And his story is actually kind of interesting. It's like, well, it's kind of cute how he even became the bishop in the first place. Fabian was a farmer, okay? He was this simple farmer, and he came to Rome to see who was going to be the successor to the office of the bishop. The bishop before him was Antarus, and Antarus had just died, and so they were going to be appointing the new bishop. And so he's like, he came into church to find out, like, oh, who's going to be taking over? And so he goes in, there's this huge crowd of people and everything. All of a sudden, a dove flies into the room and lands on Fabian's head. And everybody looks and they see this dove, you know, as they're like praying, okay, who's going to take over? Who's going to, you know, become our bishop? And they see the dove land on his head, and they took it as a sign from the Lord that he was supposed to be the next bishop. They're like, oh my gosh, it's like the Holy Spirit descending on him, you know, that this is the one. And he's like, what? You know, Fabian probably just had a huge head. Who knows? I mean, he must have just had a good runway for the dove. And so, but for whatever reason, I mean, the next thing he knows, everybody's like seeing this as a sign from God. They take him, they make him the next bishop. He's like, wait, I'm a farmer. I can't do this, you know. But he ended up doing a great job as the bishop. And so... He just took on the role. He's like, okay, this must be the will of God. And he ended up confronting a lot of heresy. He did a lot to encourage church discipline, which was starting to go downhill at that time, as I mentioned, because there had been a lot of a long period of peace. And he was very brave in confessing his faith when Decius came after him. And so he held fast to the Lord and really encouraged and strengthened the church in Rome because he ended up being martyred. He didn't deny his faith, no matter what they did to him. So I think, well, how sweet. Like, God took this little farmer and made him, like, this great inspiration and model for a lot of other people.
It's like a David story.
Yeah, totally, huh? Yeah, exactly. Shepherd, farmer. Origen was almost martyred at this time. I'm not exactly sure what happened there. It's pesky little Origen, you know. Live to go out and say some more heretical things. Anyway, and there was also, I know, he did some things that were okay, but I don't know. Origen's sketch.
I like Origen.
You like Origen? Yeah, he did a few good things. Until he got into the universalism thing there with Satan. But yeah, no, he did. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
there's a red flag there. It's like...
But he even describes like his heresies too in the... They were just kind of like, hey, you know, he had some mistakes, but...
I know. He did some good things. He did. I know. I hear you.
Yeah,
all right. Moving on. Okay. So Origen almost died, and then there was this girl who did die. Her name was Agatha. And she had kind of an interesting story. Agatha was this godly, beautiful young woman. She was, the educated class. And so she lived in Sicily. And the governor of Sicily, his name was Quintain. He was, you know, very attractive to her. And so he tried to seduce her several times, you know, tried to pressure her. And, you know, he thought, well, surely a man in my position, she would be flattered and honored by this. But she's like, heck no. And so, you know, she's just resisting him and shutting him down. And so what he did was, it's like, this is no way to win a girl's heart. He put her in custody. So take note, if any single guys in here, that's not the way to go. Yeah. And he basically put her in the custody of this prostitute you know, who was, I guess, known for being able to break down these, you know, innocent women and stuff like that and turn them into prostitutes, too. So he thought, well, this will get her to, you know, break down her morals and stuff like that. But it didn't work, you know, and he didn't know she was a Christian at the time, but, you know, if he had known, he would realize, like, that was pointless because she was like, why would I go for that, you know? So, I mean, it didn't work. It did nothing. And when he realized this, his desire for her basically turned to hatred. He's like, okay, nothing is going to work on this girl. So he got super, like, furious with her. And then he found out that she was a Christian, and he's like, sweet, now I have an excuse to really take it out on her. And so, like, what a creep. He, like, took her, had her scourged and whipped, burnt with red-hot irons, torn with hooks, and laid naked on coals and glass until she died. And so she died February of 251 A.D. There's actually, you know, the date for it and everything. So this is a very well-documented account of what a creep Quintain was. Pretty gnarly. And so, what?
That's crazy.
I know. And so she's actually depicted in a lot of art. And you see, let's see, not in this one. I had another picture somewhere where she was actually holding, because this is what the martyrs, a lot of times when they depict the martyrs, I'll talk about this in a little bit. When they depict martyrs, a lot of times they would show them with, like, the instrument of their torture as kind of a reminder of what they had gone through. So, yes, okay, there is that. I have another one where they show her, like, holding this rod thing with hooks on it. But, yeah, there's a chain down there. So that's kind of part of just, you know, that's how you see her depicted usually, is with, you know, the instrument of torture to remind people of what she went through for her faith. So, in 251, Decius died. So this was actually a pretty short persecution, just a couple years. But it was a pretty devastating one because it was all over the empire. And then a few years later, the eighth persecution broke out under Valerian. Interestingly, at the beginning of his reign in 253, he was quite favorable towards the Christians. He actually liked them and had no problem with them. The historian Eusebius, who we'll talk about next week, he said, never was there any emperor before him so favorably and benevolently disposed to Christians. All his house was filled with Christians was indeed a congregation of the Lord. Pretty amazing, okay? So it's like, what happened? What made this guy change his tune so quickly? Well, what happened was, Rome experienced a series of military disasters, and some of the people around Valerian began to blame the Christians for it. Once again, same old tune, like, this is your fault, Valerian. You've let these Christians hang around in your house, and now we've angered the gods, and now we're starting to lose all these battles. And so his tune changed, and he realized, like, uh-oh, I can't be letting this go on anymore. And so he allowed for persecution. Interestingly, though, most of the persecution was not, I mean, there was some, you know, actual violence towards the Christians, but a lot of the persecution was more economic and legal during his time. And I don't know if that was just his way of showing a little bit of mercy, you know, towards the Christians by not, you know, just automatically taking them all out and putting them to death. Instead, like I said, he barred them from legal assembly, confiscated their property, stuff like that, and so, which was still, you know, very difficult, but not as horrible. And yet there was physical torture that did go on around the empire during his time. And that persecution, it was similar to that of Decius. The punishments that Christians were put through were absolutely hideous. So whether or not Valerian himself instigated it or just allowed it, unfortunately, the Christians did end up, you know, giving, a lot of people did end up giving their lives at that time. And so, and yet in 260, 3 years later, Valerian was taken prisoner by the Emperor of Persia, and he was tortured miserably in a very similar manner to what the way in which the Christians were being persecuted. So it was kind of like, you know, what a man sows, that he shall also reap. And that's very literally seen in the life of Valerian. So I can't remember if it was Fox or where I read that, but it was, they thought it was kind of ironic that he was tortured in a similar way to the way the Christians were being tortured back in his empire. And so kind of interesting. So sometimes, you know, you do get to see that. Sometimes it's like, yeah, you see, yeah, exactly. Sometimes the Lord allows justice to be seen and served in that time. A ninth persecution was under Aurelian, and I don't, you know, have a whole lot to say about this particular one. It was a pretty brief persecution.
It was only a year after.
74? Oh, this would have been 14 years later. Yeah. Oh, the other one was, yeah, 57. So, yeah. Like I said, this was a brief persecution, and besides this persecution, the church was at peace for about 40 years until, dun-dun-dun, the 10th one, and this one was a doozy, under Diocletian and Galerius. Look at Galerius. It's like who the heck put his, I mean, man. Either if he was like, I know, he like had like a bunch of Red Bulls or something when he posed for that. I don't know. Look, it's like, bing, his eyes are so kind of creepy. I couldn't find any other pictures, though, so I was like, oh, wow, this is what we're going to have.
He looks crazy.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He's been drinking Red Bull for, a month straight. Or just psycho in general, which he was. Possessed, which is also very true. So, after so much peace, the church was definitely, I guess you could kind of say they needed another wake-up call of sorts. Things had gotten even more complacent and compromised than during the previous period of peace. And so, this was where we start seeing what we talked about last week, last class, with leaving their first love and stuff like that. This was when the church really was kind of losing focus, was at this time in the early 300s. Eusebius said, "Who could describe the huge congregations that gathered in every city and the distinguished crowds in the churches, on whose account, not content with the ancient buildings, they erected spacious churches in all the cities. By reason of excessive liberty, we sank into negligence and sloth. We envied and reviled one another. We were almost taking arms against each other, people rising up against people." So, I mean, it was getting, it was getting kind of ugly in the church. You know, people were, like I said, losing their focus. They weren't, having their eyes on Jesus as they had been previously. And I don't think you could say that that was happening across the board everywhere, but there was a large degree of, prosperity and complacency that was taking place. And so, even though persecution was bad, it was a terrible thing, the Lord did use it for good in waking up his church. So, let's talk about Diocletian, the guy who started this one off. Diocletian was a statesman. He wasn't a soldier. Remember Decius, he was a Roman general kind of a guy. Diocletian was a politician. And he realized the importance of reorganizing the empire at this point. So the Roman Empire has existed for almost 300 years at this point, and they're spread out all over the place. He's like, we need to reorganize here. Things are starting to get a little out of hand. There were these warriors known as the barbarians, who we're going to be talking about in the coming weeks. They were starting to invade the empire from the north of Europe, from up in Scandinavia and, Iceland, the Vikings, those kind of guys. They're all coming down and starting to try to pick off pieces of the empire on the outskirts. And he's like, okay, we can't let that happen anymore. We need to do something about this and reorganize and restructure. So what he did was, in 286, he gave the honor of co-regency of the empire to a guy named Maximian. And in 293, let's go ahead and I'll put this up here so you guys can see it. Okay, and divvied up the empire into east and west. So he said, okay, look, Maximian, you take the eastern side of the empire. I'm going to take the western side of the empire. That way we have a strong presence, a strong empirical presence on both sides. So we can kind of, keep control of this situation and put out these, little fires that are happening with the barbarians coming in. And so in 293, 7 years later, he said, let's restructure a little bit further and let's have a couple guys subordinate to us who will help in the administration of the empire as well. And so he took in the west a guy named Constantius, and he gave Maximian a guy named Galerius over in the east to help administrate the empire. And so they were like the subordinate Caesar, the little Caesars. Call them the little Caesars underneath. Okay, the big Caesars, basically. Okay. So that's what we call them. So even though Diocletian had so much on his plate, but now he felt that he could consider what to do about the Christians. He's like, okay, now I've kind of divvied out some of the responsibility here. Let's focus on some of these other issues we have, like these pesky Christians that we cannot get rid of. Now, Maximian and Galerius hated the Christians, and they pressured Diocletian to do something about it. The only reason he withstood for so long was really more a matter of policy. It wasn't that he was really sympathetic to the Christians. He just didn't know how to deal with them, and he had been pondering it. And so these guys came at him and they said, you know what you need to do? You just need to wipe them out. We need to just get rid of these guys once and for all. They've been a blemish on the empire for over 200 years now. Let's do something about it. And so finally he gave in to Galerius in particular. Galerius, the psycho from the previous photo right there. Okay, he's the one who really was calling for this more than anyone else. And so February 24th, 303, an edict was published calling for Terminalia. which would be the utter and complete obliteration of Christianity from the empire, as the name indicates, right? Terminalia. You guys can, I'll just write it down so you can see. Obviously, the word terminate is in that. And that is exactly what they wanted to do. So it was a systematic attempt to not just persecute, but thoroughly destroy the Christian faith. So this was the worst, it was the most disgusting persecution. It got so bad that the Roman officials got fed up with all of the carnage. Remember before I told you that some of the spectators, the Roman public, got kind of grossed out. Well, now even the Roman officials got to the point where they were like, okay, this is just too much carnage, there's too much bloodshed, this is out of control. Even the executioners were getting too worn out to keep going. You know, they were like, man, I'm just like, killed way too many people today, I need a break, you know? They all wanted to go on vacation. So everybody was tired, and it just got out of control. But because they wanted the Christians to recant, to deny their faith, not just die, the tortures they came up with were just diabolical, just evil, demonic, twisted, horrible stuff that they did to the Christians. I mean, and a lot of bad stuff had happened before, but, you know, this was like, wow, taking it to a new level. I'm going to just tell one story, I think that's enough, about a Christian man named Peter. It says of Peter, he was commanded to sacrifice to the emperor, but as he refused, he was ordered to be raised in midair, scourged all over his naked body until he would obey. As he was immovable amid all these sufferings, his bones already appearing bared of the flesh, they mixed vinegar with salt and poured it on the mangled parts of his body. A gridiron, which was like a giant barbecue, and fire was produced, and the remnants of his body, like pieces of meat for roasting and eating, were placed in the fire. Not at once so that he would die, but little by little. Isn't that sick? I mean, they basically just treated him, yeah, well, like a dead animal, basically, and they're just putting him on, but not, like, they didn't just throw him on there. They, like, little by little, like, put his arm on there and then put his, you know, it was just gross. Super twisted. The amazing thing is that this guy did not deny his faith.
Ooh.
I know. Yeah, I know. Talk about hardcore. I'm just amazed at some of these. So I think that story is enough of a picture of just, you know, how sadistic and twisted this got. So May of 305, so 2 years later, Diocletian had been sick the previous year. He had gotten really ill, and so he was like, you know, I don't think I can do this anymore. He started to realize that maybe it was time for him to pass on the throne. And so he forced Maximian to also abdicate. So they both abdicated the throne, and Galerius and Constantius ended up taking over. Okay, ooh, look how they fade out, my cool graphics. Ooh, okay, so now Constantius and Galerius are in charge. I tried to figure out how to move them up, but I didn't know how to do that. So I have a lot of work to do on my tech skills. Anyways, so Constantius and Galerius now become the supreme emperors of the empire, and underneath them, they went ahead and appointed two Caesars, like the little Caesars under them, okay? And we'll come to that. We'll get more into that next week. So Constantius was a good guy, and he basically stopped the persecution of the church in the West. He's like, okay, that's enough. If Diocletian's going to give me the throne, I'm going to go ahead and just end this right now. This is getting out of control. And so he ended the persecution in the West, and then he died a year later, and his son Constantine came to the throne, and that brings up a whole new time in history, which we'll get into next week. And continued to favor the Christians. But over in the East, Galerius was so consumed with hatred of the Christians that he continued Terminalia in the eastern part of the empire for several more years, along with the co-regent, the guy that was underneath him. However, it became quite apparent that they were not going to be able to stamp out Christianity. The more they tried, the more Christians just kept popping up all over the place. Plus, it got to the point where there was so much infighting going on between these guys, a lot of power politics going on between the East and the West and everything. And that started to take away the focus, where Galerius realized, I can't be spending all my time and energy on the Christian thing. I need to deal with more of these political matters that are going on. And so, finally, in 311, the Edict of Toleration was signed. And that announced that, basically what it announced was that the persecution had failed. And, quote, it has been impossible to induce the Christians to abandon their obstinate way of life. And so, thus ended the final, I'm going to put that down, the Edict of Toleration, because that was kind of that was an important one. I know you guys don't need to do timelines or anything anymore, because that's so nice, but... of some of these key things. 311, the Edict of Toleration. And so thus ended the final and the most severe persecution of the early church. And so I think this just goes to show exactly what Romans 8 says, that in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. And this is a beautiful picture of that, I think, just how the Lord, yeah, again, made us victorious, made the church victorious, how he came in and just, you know, no matter what the enemy threw at the church, no matter what the enemy threw at the people of God, it couldn't be stomped out. Julian the Apostate said on his deathbed, "Galilean, thou hast conquered," speaking to Jesus. And I think that just sums it up so well. It's like at the end of the day, Jesus will always have the last word. The God will always have the last word. And so I think that's encouraging too when we face dark times now and just see the way things are going and, oh my gosh, how is the church going to survive? It's like God has always been faithful in even darker times than we're facing now, and he always will be. And so, and we know this, but it's just encouraging to see these things in history to give us perspective. So we realize, like, okay, it's actually been, you know, even worse. It's been terrible before, and yet the light still shone bright, you know, the gospel still shone through. Amazing, amazing. So, after the persecutions ended, there was a lot of drama among the four Roman heads of state. Eventually, we're going to see Constantine emerge as supreme emperor. That'll bring us into a whole new era next week. But before we finish, oh goodness, I'm going late. Sorry, guys. Before we head on, I just really quickly want to bring out a little bit of side info related to art, because I think that's kind of interesting, and I mentioned it earlier. Because those who suffered and died for their faith, rightly so, I think they were, you know, they were loved by the church as the years went by. People really, you know, were stirred up and, you know, inspired by their testimonies, and, you know, they were very well respected. And so their stories were preserved and kept alive into the Middle Ages, which is a great thing. You know, that's how we have these accounts now. But these people were then canonized. Do you guys know what that means when you're canonized?
It's considered whatever you say is inspired by God.
Well, kind of. You're thinking of that. Okay, sorry. You're going on. That's a good track. But actually, just being canonized in church terms means to become a saint, be made a saint. Okay. So they were made saints by the church, and then they were depicted, that's all right, in all kinds of art, and, you know, and the art had to do with the stories of their martyrdoms, like I said, because it would remind people of what they had gone through as kind of a testimony and as an inspiration to them. And so, you know, I mean, even though the whole turning people into saints, we're going to get into that later and why that was a bad idea, but we can thank the church for preserving these stories, because that's, you know, an awesome part of our Christian heritage that we can still learn from today. Let's see, I just wanted to show you a few of these things because, like I said, their stories were depicted in art, their martyrdoms, and then there was a lot of symbolism that would indicate that this person was martyred for their faith so that people would know. And remember, when in the day and ages we're going to see, people, you know, in the Middle Ages were illiterate, they didn't know how to read, and so a lot of things were expressed to people through art, and so this would be helpful for them to know the stories of those who had gone before, even though they couldn't read it for themselves. We'll get into all that later. But anyway, so we have here, this is St. Catherine of Alexandria, and she was, and this, like, this panel down here, they made, like, depicts her whole story about how she, you know, was arrested and taken in and she was miraculously delivered. They basically put her on this wheel, like, kind of like the rack to try to, you know, stretch and break all of her bones, and the wheel broke as they were trying to, you know, torture her. Everything, the whole machinery just kind of fell apart and everything, and people took that as divine deliverance and stuff. Eventually, though, she was taken out, as you can see, and beheaded for her faith. But when she's depicted in art, she's usually depicted with the wheel because that was something that, you know, she had been, that had been a torture device for her. The other thing to note is that she's holding a palm branch up in this picture here. And a lot of times, even if you don't see, like, an instrument of torture or whatever, you'll see in any pictures of the most pictures of the martyrs, you'll see palm branches because the palm branch was considered a symbol of victory. You know, in this case, victory over death, victory over, you know, the enemy, that kind of a thing.
Like when Jesus came into Jerusalem and they had
the... Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's the same. And that had been a symbol. Palm branches were a symbol for centuries of victory and that sort of a thing. And so it was just applied and adapted to the martyrs here as symbolic of their victory over the grave. And see, she's holding one there. That one looks like just a piece of grass, but whatever. Anyway. So that's St. Catherine of Alexandria. Couple more examples. St. Cecilia. She's considered the patron saint of music because it was said that she was a Christian, forced to marry an unbeliever. And so on her wedding day, it was said as she walked down the aisle to this pagan wedding music, in her heart she was singing hymns to the Lord. And so that was the way the story ran. And so she became known as the patron saint of music. So usually you see her depicted holding different instruments. I guess she played mariachi because that's kind of what that looks like right there. Or like the organ here, you know, stuff like that. Usually you also see the palm branch. I don't think it's in this particular stained glass there, but you know, there's other symbols that they use in art, like the red, like signifying the blood, and you know, the robes, yeah, just like rich robes signifying like royalty in a way, like she went on into, you know, to heaven and to, you know, the kingdom of God, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, halos,
that happened a lot. Well, that was used a lot, obviously, to depict the saints because they were considered very special. And so there's a lot of other symbols in some of these that they have as well, but that's kind of the gist. And then Agnes, I like this one because this is kind of interesting. Agnes was martyred during the 9th persecution, I think. And she was basically this 12 or 13-year-old girl. And at that time, you know, back in the day, young girls, you could be 13 or 14 and you were being, you know, engaged to be married and stuff like that. So she had a lot of suitors, but she was a Christian, and so she shut down any of the guys that weren't saved. And so a couple of creeps, you know, that she had rejected, they got together and they decided, man, we're going to get her in trouble, man, you know, because their pride was all hurt. So they basically snitched on her. They told on her to the authorities. They had her arrested and brought in. And everybody felt really awkward because it was like this, you know, it's like a little junior high girl and you're like interrogating her about her faith. It's kind of like, okay, this is kind of weird, you know, but she wouldn't deny her faith. And so they ordered for her to be, but first she was like verbally just assaulted and abused. And then they started torturing her. And eventually she ended up dying for her faith. But loads of people got saved because of her testimony, because here she was, this little girl, and she never denied her faith. It was a very powerful testimony. So she's depicted in a lot of art. And it's interesting. And so she's obviously holding the branch to indicate that she was a martyr. And then a lot of times you see her holding a lamb, which would signify, obviously, her purity and her innocence and all of that, and her youth, you know. But also, there's another little symbolism thing going on here, because in Latin, does anybody know what the Latin word for lamb is? Ah, agnus, A-G-N-U-S. And so there was also a little play on words going on here. Agnus is lamb, so Agnus Dei is the Lamb of God. So if that, you know, Agnus and Agnes, you know, there was a similarity there. And so they kind of tied that in together. Woo, kind of fun, huh? And then, whoops, last but not least, we have St. Justina. And a unicorn. I know. Random. Okay, so I just always like this one because it's really like, wow, you know, it's kind of a cool painting. And this random guy, you know, these guys are hilarious. The artists sometimes, like Moretto de Brescia, basically just painted himself into this painting because he really liked Justina. He's like, oh, I just honor this saint, and so I'm going to put myself in there. All right, so the unicorn, I researched the unicorn out. It's kind of random, but apparently, unicorns represented purity and virginity. And so there was this old legend that unicorns were attracted to young virgin women. And so, I mean, I'm like, what does that mean? They all just come stampeding towards any time they see a girl walking around? I don't know. But anyways, basically that's what it was, that they were attracted to young women. And so, not attracted in that way, but you know what I mean, drawn to them. And so that's why the unicorn is there, because it represents the fact that she was pure when she died and all that sort of a thing. So there you go. I know for years I didn't know what that meant. I just liked the picture, and so I showed the classes, and I was like, what the heck is a unicorn for? So I finally had to go and figure it out. All right, so there's your art history lesson for the evening, and now I'm finally letting you out. All right. So, Lord Jesus, thank you for this time. Thank you for these testimonies, Lord, these that were faithful unto death. And just what a reminder this is, God, that no matter how dark it gets and how the enemy might just come in like a flood, the Spirit of the Lord will raise up a standard against him. You always do, just like it says there in Isaiah, God. You always raise up that standard. You always win the day. You always are victorious. You are the conqueror. And we thank you so much for that, Lord. And may that give us increased confidence, Lord, in as we just shine for you and live for you in our workplaces, in our homes, among our friends, Lord. May we just be bold for you, Lord, knowing we're on the winning side, Lord, the victorious side. And God, may we just show your love, just as these martyrs did, Lord. Always such an example of love and patience and kindness that won so many over to you, Lord. May we just live in such a way that others would be just so impacted and so drawn to your great love for them, God. So we love you. We thank you. Go before us the rest of this week in your name. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks, guys.
Sorry we're late. Did I just push stop, Sean?
What was it?
Yeah.